We're up to Parshat Bechukotai. Parshat Bechukotai, in a nutshell, tells us, keep my Torah, things will be good. Don't keep my Torah, things will be bad. Okay, that's the Parsha in a nutshell. Many promises of how good it's going to be if we keep the Torah. And a long warning of what can happen if we transgress the Torah. Now, the warning here is about half the size of the warning in the book of Devarim. When we reach the book of Devarim, otherwise known as Deuteronomy, Moshe Rabbeinu reviews the rebuke in this week's parasha, and it's almost double. He goes at length, telling us how bad it can become. Nachmanides fills us in with a scary concept. He says, when we read the rebuke in this week's parasha, it all came true with the destruction of the first temple. And you read the rebuke in Deuteronomy, that's all been coming true ever since the destruction of the second temple. So the destruction of the second temple actually led us to an exile that's much, much longer than the 70 years of exile that happened at the destruction of the first temple. After the destruction of the first temple, we were exiled primarily to one location, out to Babylon. And so we were very near Israel. And it was one location, it was a nation we were familiar with. So too in this week's parasha, the description of the exile is about a country that's not so far away. They're going to come and exile us. The description of the exile in Deuteronomy is about a nation you won't even understand their language. They're going to take you out to sea, they will take you far away. They will do atrocities you've never heard of or thought of. And so our sages actually point out to us that these two prophecies, the prophecy of Bechukotai and the prophecy we'll see in Devarim, the prophecy, these prophecies actually came true in two periods of Jewish history. Each one's alluding to a different period, and we will see how the verses actually are very, very, very defined that way. You see, in this rebuke, the Torah says, the land will remain fallow to make up for all the Shemitah years you transgressed. That's not talking about the destruction of the second temple. You know, we were out of Israel for over a millennium. So that's referring to the 70 years, the exile of 70 years after the destruction of the first temple. And as you notice, if you pay close attention, you'll see that the verses fit very, very clearly. They fit the destruction of the first temple. There's one commentary, Rabbi Ovadia of Sephorno, who actually goes piece by piece, verse by verse, and shows how it actually came true in the destruction of the first temple. He doesn't mention this over here, that this rebuke is this, and that rebuke is that. Nachmanides spells it out. But nonetheless, that's the line he takes in interpreting it. Our tradition and the way we set up our calendar and the way we set up our Torah reading is that we will always read Bechukosai prior to Shavuos. And it's not the final Torah reading before Shavuos. We always read the rebukes prior to. So if in Devarim, when we read the Tochacha in Parshas Kisavo, so that is always before Nitzavim, which is before Rosh Hashanah, then over here we'll always read Bechukosai before Shavuos. We're going to have at least one more week, and this year we have 2 weeks before Shavuos, and the idea is Tichle Shana Vekilelotea. We know the year has different starting points pertaining to different halachos. So we always want to finish the year. All the curses of the year should end with this. It's as though we want to leave the curses behind us. So we conclude this segment of the year. We conclude the curses before we conclude the segment of the year. So to speak, we're saying we want to begin next year fresh. So we're going to leave the curses behind us. We're going to finish them just before we finish the year. Okay, so that brings us into Parshat Bechukotai. Okay, the Torah begins and says, Im Bechukotai Telechu, if you follow my rules and you observe my mitzvos, the rain will come in its set time, the land will produce bounty, and you'll have tremendous sustenance. Even wild animals won't harm you. Obviously, your enemies will be on the run, and you'll be victorious very easily, and I will bless you. So what is a chok? What is a chok? Chok is commonly translated as a statute. a law that is not necessarily logically understood. But the word chok also means the encompassing way of life that God has given us. Just like in modern Hebrew, chukah is the legal system, so too the word chok in Torah very often means the whole legal system of the Torah, the whole system of the Torah. Im bechukotai telechu, if you will behave in accordance with my system that I've given you. And this is the root, this pasuk is the root of the word we often use, halacha. Why do we call Jewish law halacha, the walking? Because to walk in the path of the Torah, that's how the Torah describes it here. Im bechukotai telechu. If you walk in the system of the Torah, if you behave within that system, it's called, so to speak, to walk within the system. That's why we call it halacha. Ve'et mitzvotai tishmeru. And you will watch to observe my mitzvos. What does that mean? It means two things. One is to be careful to actually do a mitzvah. You got to get up in order to put on tefillin in the day. You got to remember to count Sefiras HaOmer tonight. Very easy to say it is 28 days in the Omer, which are 4 weeks in the Omer. That's easy to say. But you got to actually remember. You got to pay attention. So the first thing the Torah is saying when it says watch the mitzvos is to actually take care to do it. If you don't buy matzahs, you're not going to have matzahs. You don't buy loaf and ester, you ain't going to have one. So you got to watch to do it. But there's another concept here that's intrinsic to the word watch my mitzvos. The mitzvos have an underlying theme. The Torah is pushing us in a certain direction. And sometimes a person can take the mitzvah and leave out the spirit of the mitzvah. And then it's like, I tell the story of two guys in yeshiva that are standing and thinking deep philosophical thoughts at 2 o'clock in the morning. And they're in the hallway of the dorm room. And one turns to the other in excitement and says, the most important thing in life, and he's saying at the top of his lungs, is that you have good traits, that you're a nice human being. And with that, the whole dorm room turns on and goes, shh. Right? You know, it's the middle of the night. So you can be pursuing a mitzvah in one direction and forget the whole spirit of the mitzvah in another direction. So that's why the Torah says, watch the mitzvos. Watch the mitzvos means two things. One is to actually do them, and the other one is to maintain their spirit. Not just to do them, but also to understand what God wants of us within the mitzvah. There's a famous story of Rabbi Aryeh Levin, that he was going to buy an esrog. We have a mitzvah to take an esrog on Sukkos, right? So the Torah refers to an esrog as a pri eitz hadar, a fruit that is glorified, right? So from there we infer that the esrog you buy should be something glorious. Try to get a nice esrog. So people will sometimes spend hours and go from store to store looking at their esrog to get the nicest esrog. So the story goes, and I wasn't there, this is before I was born, the story goes that this young student wanted to see how Rabbi Aryeh Levin buys his esrog. So he sees him going to the sale of esrogim, and he says, Rabbi, can I come along? And Rabbi Levin says, fine. And he runs in, he looks through a few esrogim, he takes one, pays for it, and runs out. And the student says, Rabbi, wait, I have a question. So he says, I'm sorry, we can talk on the way, but I have to run right now, I'm in a big rush. So he goes along, and Rabbi Aryeh Levin is going, and on the way he asks him, wait, you have a mitzvah to buy a pre-Eitz Hadar, a fruit that's glorious. How do you do it so fast? Why did you do it so fast? So he said, well, I have a mitzvah now to visit an old man. There's an old man who I'm visiting now, and the Torah uses the same term, Hadar, about an old man. It says, v'hadarta p'nei zaken. When you see someone elder, so treat them in a way that makes them feel glorified. So you have two terms, two places in Torah where you have the term hidur. If I have to choose between investing in the inanimate object or the human being, I rather rush to do stress the mitzvah with the human being. And it also says hadar there. So somehow we have an easier time investing our efforts in a citron than sitting in an old age home with someone and wiping the saliva off their chin. We don't feel like we're doing so much there. But the truth is, if we're trying to understand what the Torah wants of us, then maybe we would think about it differently. So that's mitzvotai tishmeru. to watch the mitzvahs, to understand what the Torah is really wanting of us. And then the Torah says, "Vasitem otam," you will do them. One of the mistakes people sometimes make is that they think, I'm not going to get all 613 anyways, so let me choose the ones I can do. It doesn't work that way. We have to aspire for all 613. It's true, in the tshuva process, you guys know, I'll often tell you, don't run for stringencies, don't be so quick to take this on or that on. That's true. I'll often tell a person, don't daven three times a day, slowly. You're just getting used to eating kosher, you're just getting used to keeping Shabbos. You can't take on the whole world in 1 minute, it doesn't work that way. That's true, there's a process, a person's tshuva takes time. You can't do it overnight, and if you do, it won't last. But the aspiration has to be to keep all 613. The fact that we're a work in progress, yes, that's the logical way to grow. But that doesn't mean we're compromising. We're doing the best we can. The best we can means we're going to do things methodically, consistently, and gradually. The key point being gradually. But we're also going to be consistent. By doing it gradually, we can be consistent. And our consistent goal is to get to 613. That doesn't mean I beat up on myself because I don't do all 613 yet. I keep working to get there. But that's why the Torah says you can do all the mitzvos. Vasitem otam. And that's, you will perform the mitzvos with love. One of the reasons a person has to grow gradually is because otherwise he'll hate it. One of the rules to gauge if you're growing too quickly is this question. Are you generally happy with what you're doing? If a person is generally upset and uptight and he finds it so hard to be Jewish, then he's growing too fast. So then go slower. Take a few steps back and reset. Hit the reset button and start again. So the Torah says, okay, you do all of this, the rain will come on time, and all the wonderful material things will happen. Wait a second. I do the spiritual things. You'll give me the material things? If what's important is the spiritual, so then why is God saying, you do all that, I'll give you all the other stuff? It seems like a contradiction. So Maimonides says, well, we all know we need food to live on, right? We need peace. We need time. We need all the material things in order to move forward, in order to do anything. You need that. You need shelter. So the Torah is telling you, and that's the big promise in the days of the Messiah, things will be peaceful. So what? That's the best you can offer me? No. That's the starting point. The Torah was saying, it's not nice to make me laugh, you know. The Torah was saying if you, it is nice to make me laugh, not in the middle of a thought. The Torah was saying that it will give us all these material goods, so we don't have to waste time on them. The reason people were always wanting to reach the days of the Messiah was so that they could serve God in peace. They don't have to worry about all the other things. And I want to throw a big question at you, and I hope you won't hold it against me, but you have to ask yourself this question as you go through life. How much money do you have to make? Meaning, we live in a day where, I don't want to sound messianic, but I often wonder to myself, people say, I'm waiting for the Messiah. And I often wonder, how do you know he hasn't come already? So they'll tell me there's still suffering in the world. And I'll say, that's true. The world is not yet perfect. But the world is so much better. I had the good fortune last week to visit a friend who was sick at home after a heart attack. And as we were talking, he said to me, what's happening with your siblings? Are they making aliyah? And I said, you know, they're getting their act together. They're working on it, but it's not so easy, you know, with the family and moving over your source of livelihood and finding a community, etc. So this is a friend who actually made aliyah. And he said a very stinging remark. He said to me, you're 100% right that it's not easy. But you know what? It has never been easier. And it struck me. I never thought of that.
You know, this is the easiest time in world history to make Aliyah. We like to think about that. It's not so easy, and that's true.
In the time of Ezra?
What? Oh, yes. Read about what happened when Ezra came. It took him a year traveling without anything.
Getting here was
right.
Unbelievable. Most didn't make it.
Yeah. Look at the Gra, who tried so hard, and he didn't make it. Look at the...
Had to throw his books out in the water.
Look at
time. The problem is over there has also gotten so much easier.
Okay, but I'm saying the line blew me away.
Sure.
Wow. I never thought of that. Okay, that's food for thought. So, coming back to our parsha. So today we have these blessings. But if we're going to spend life thinking about how much I want more, so then it's very hard to find time to learn Torah and to actually excel in doing mitzvot. Because there's always room to do more. And you could always make more, and you could always have more amenities, and you could have two cars, and etc., etc., etc. So that's a question you have to ask yourself throughout life. We call it getting ahead. I don't know. I think people make two mistakes. Number one, they don't invest and save for the future. So they think they've gotten ahead because they have a newer iPhone. Maybe they'd have gotten ahead if they would have invested in something that will give them dividends for the next 10 years. Then I could hear that they got ahead. I don't know that they got ahead just because they have a classy iPhone to show everyone, and I'm not sure they got ahead. So that's one mistake people make. And number two is that people keep thinking they need to get ahead. I think people need to get stable and need to have sources of income so that they can invest less time working. And what do you do with that time? So that's more time learning and more time doing mitzvot. There's a lot of good to be done out here. I spoke to the head of a kollel in Tel Aviv this morning. And he said to me, one of his students said to him, do we have room for more students here? And he said, after you bring me 5,000 students, then I'll start worrying about room. But right now Tel Aviv needs at least 5,000 students. If we have 5,000 more people here, each one doing outreach, teaching children, explaining what Judaism is all about, then we could start talking about getting ground for more students. But right now we need 5,000. Yeah, there's a lot to do. Coming back to our parsha, the Torah says, I will dwell in your midst. And that's a special blessing that Hashem says, He will dwell among us. The idea that we have a Mishkan, the tabernacle, a central place of worshiping Hashem, is a weakness. It's because we didn't live up to our responsibilities. If we'd have lived up to our responsibilities, the Shekhinah would have been in everyone's home. Our homes would have been the Mishkan. It's because our homes aren't holy enough that there has to be a central house of worship. God says, you will chase your enemies. So, about a decade ago, maybe even more, there was a rabbi who was discussing this concept, which appears in a few places in Torah, that we try to wage war on enemy ground. The Torah instructs us, chase your enemies. In other words, if there has to be a war, do it on their territory. Don't do it on your territory. When we discuss war, the Torah says, "Ki teitze lamilchama," when you go out to war. One of the reasons we were successful in the Six-Day War is because we waged most of the war on their territory. One of the reasons we lost so many casualties in the Yom Kippur War is because most of the war was waged on our territory. So the Torah repeatedly describes war as being outside because the Torah wants us to view war that way. If you have to go to war, try to keep it outside your territory. So there was a rabbi who said this in a speech, and he showed it from Rashi. He said the great commentary, Rabbi Rashi, this is in his interpretation, and he was giving the speech where President Bush was present. And this was just when President Bush was talking about waging the war on terror. And he liked it so much after the speech, he went over to the rabbi. And he said, this Rashi, where can I meet him? I want him to speak on behalf of the war on terror. Because he's got the right idea.
Yeah.
The rabbi was like,
I saw that in a news article, and somebody had photoshopped George W. walking along with a Schottenstein Gemara in his hand, you know?
So coming back to our parasha, so that's the the promise that few of us will chase many of them. God says there will be a tremendous success in our military campaigns. Ufaniti aleichem. And even when you reach a point where the nations will have few numbers, I will still focus on you and you will have blessing. And it's interesting that the parsha alludes to an idea of the end of time, and it alludes to the idea that there will be remnants from the nations. We know there's the famous prophecies of Gog and Magog, 70 nations coming to the doorsteps of Jerusalem, exiling us into the desert, a great war, etc. But here we find that there will be remnants. It's not like there'll be nothing left of the nations.
But in the future, the majority of human population will be Jewish?
Yeah. That's in the prophecy we read on Yom Tov too. Sure. In Sukkot we read it, yeah.
Right. What about the 70 nations that come at Sukkot time?
Right. So you see there's a remnant, right? You're saying it's indicated there, right? Now, the Torah then says, okay, and what happens if you don't? And here, it's very interesting, the sequence. The Torah says, the Torah is going to discuss how a person leaves Torah. And the Torah says, first, im lo tishma'uli, you won't listen. So the first step is that a person doesn't want to hear what the Torah has to say. He's not interested. And from there it evolves to lo ta'asu, the next words in the pasuk. Those of you who are following inside, pasuk yud dalid. It's a very clear ordering. And one can even note, what Rashi does not point out, is that it begins with lo ta'asu et kol ha-mitzvot ha'ele. That a person begins by saying, I just won't do all of them. I'm just going to take off a few. And then, b'chukotai timasu. It reaches a point where a person finds the statutes revolting. He begins by saying, this doesn't make sense to me, and that doesn't make sense to me. I'm not doing this. And then it evolves into et mishpatai tigal nafshechem. Even the things that are logical, a person says, I can't stand living my life this way. And then a person reaches a point where he says, I can't stand that others are doing it. And then a person says, I don't want to let others doing it. So he tells his neighbor, you know, it bothers me that you blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. Wait a second, you can blast your stereo, but I can't blow my shofar? It strikes me, when I go on a bus, so very often I offer people, I'm going to say Tefillah Saderech, do you want me to say it on your behalf too? Usually most of the bus is interested. So I'll say Tefillah Saderech out loud, and even people without yarmulkes, even women who are obviously not observant, are interested in listening and saying Amen. It's a prayer that takes 20 seconds. And every so often there'll be one wise Alec who will say, why can you force us to do something religious? Now if you think about it logically, that's not fair. Most of the bus, most of the time, wants that prayer. So this individual wants to force me to be quiet even though he's outnumbered. Logic would say, let's take a vote. How many people don't want it? But what happens is a person doesn't realize. He evolves to a state where he's not happy with other people doing mitzvahs. What does he care? You want to lead your life your way, that's fine, but why do you want to stop me? So the Torah warns us. It begins by saying, I don't want to hear, and then I don't want to do, and then I don't want others to do, and then I can't stand others who do, and then let me get in the way of others who do. And then finally it reaches the point where a person says, I don't even believe in all this. And that's why our sages warned us, Heveratz lemitzvah kala. A person should try to pursue even a light mitzvah. And a person should try to distance himself even from a light sin. Because the nature of things is that we enter cycles. And cycles have a snowball effect. So a person has to try to get into a positive cycle that has a snowball effect in the positive direction. One of the best things you can do after you leave Machon Meir, make sure there's a place where you can go once a day. It could be the shul, it could be a beis medrash, where you're a part of a crowd that's learning Torah. It could be the Hillel in your university campus. But you got to be a part of a system that propels a person forward. Don't try to do it alone at home. By the way, if we mentioned university, some of you are leaving within the next month. You got to go to a campus with our good Jewish girls. There have to be Jewish girls. You're going to go to a campus. What? Well, obviously, it's better if you go where there are religious Jewish girls. But at a minimum, they should be Jewish. Preferably religious, obviously.
New York. Jewish religious girls from what I heard up there.
Okay. Some people have done their research already. Okay, that's good. It's important. Okay, so the Torah starts warning us. The Torah warns us about different diseases that can come. The Torah warns us that people can plant and they won't have any vegetation. Now, what brings a person to this level of sin where he can't stand the Torah? So our sages have an interesting line. Usually it's attributed to Maimonides, but really this concept is already in the Talmud. It's based on a verse in the prophet Hosea. The Talmud says the Jewish people knew that paganism was a lie. They knew it was a farce. Yodim ayu Yisrael ba'avodah zarah shelo haya ba'mamash. The people of Israel knew that there was no substance to idol worship. V'lo avdu avodah zarah ela kedei la'tir lehem arayot b'farhesia. So why did they adopt paganism? Why were the Jews so quick to shift after idol worship? Because they wanted to have open promiscuity. That's the desire that drives a person. When a person is reneging on his faith, the reason is because deep down inside he really wants something. God created us with a very powerful drive. Now that drive also drives us to deny the truths that we know deep down inside. And then we have the evolvement.
Why do you think it's that way?
I was quoting a Gemara.
From the sound of it, it was kind of like it went for a circle. It went to denying it so much that you kind of want it again.
What do you mean? I didn't come.
As in, you were saying you have this desire to, you have this desire, right? And even though you're repressing it, it's still there.
The desire for open promiscuity?
Oh, no.
Saying a person knows it's true. No, he knows the Torah is true, but he also knows he has desires for open promiscuity. And so there's a contradiction. I can't do what I desire if the Torah is true. So then I'm going to find fault in the Torah. Slowly but surely, I'll find ways out.
It's the desire that's the key, right? I mean, for most people, it's the promiscuity. But if someone has a desire, I want all the wealth, or I want all the power, or I want all... It's to follow his own desire.
Could be, but the Talmud said this.
Yeah, no, I mean, saying we see it, billion-dollar industries, and we see in all over the place that when they talk about the golden calf, right? So that was the big thing too, right? These orgies and stuff, as opposed to.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that.
So, you want a piece of- so we see that Anshei Knesset Gedolah, did away with, locked up the desire for Avodah Zarah. Then after that succeeded, they went ahead and gave it a try for the other, more powerful drive. But if, as you're saying, that the whole reason for the interest in Avodah Zarah was because of this desire for promiscuity, why did they not just try and get rid of the sexual urge in the first place? It obviously didn't work, but if that was the reason for it, then they wouldn't have had to have got rid of Avodah Zarah. And at the same time, they would have kept Nevuah, because it went with the Avodah Zarah, right? So, it would have made more sense just to get rid of the desire for promiscuity, and then no one would have done Avodah Zarah, because they all knew it was wrong. It's less pressing to make sense. So.
I need to think about it. I don't want to give you an answer off the cuff. I think there are answers that come to mind, but I never thought of the question, so I'd rather give it more thought.
When you say promiscuity, it's difficult because there's a positive element to sexual desire as well. To use positively what by Avodah Zarah you think is only negative.
I said open promiscuity.
Right.
It's interesting that the Talmud says that. There was this great desire to breach the boundaries of modesty,
right,
as well as promiscuity.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Right. I'd say that the Talmud puts
did
that
we,
word in.
Did we invite
right.
Their public?
Right.
That's
just a second. Yechiel was waiting. I'm sorry. Yes, Yechiel.
Can we talk about
About what?
For my understanding, in India, we have Abu Dazara in the classic way, like classic way, idols, statues, carvings, something like that. But open from his feet, we can find in England, in United States. And because I live in Romania, it was very interesting for me. For the poor people, you must be quiet family, but they have party with the, in the communist party. When they can't separate the husband and the wife, they sleep each other without problem. Still today, the communist party do that. So, where is Abu Dazara in the in communist or in
communist, in the communist party?
Like the social party, like Kadima, it's a party.
Not like
a
party.
Political party.
I didn't follow. What's the question? So, where is open? I think that it's open for mosquito, even in the United States, even in China, even in the communists or were non-communists. So where is Abu Dazara in America, in Russia?
You wanna know?
I don't understand, in all honesty, I don't understand when the Talmud says what Akiva quoted, that and it's based on verses in Treyasar, that men of the great assembly were able to take away the desire for paganism. I don't understand what we see today in the world. I don't understand why some countries, you could say that in the United States people are looking for karma and all kinds of forces and they're looking for order in their life in that direction. You could discuss the paganism within Christianity and the paganism within Islam. You could discuss that, but I don't understand it. In all honesty, I don't really know how this works, that in the Far East you still have things that seem much more pagan than what you see in Christianity and Islam, and why that would be so. I don't know. I don't know how that works with the Gemara. I don't know what the world was like 500 years ago. From the little I know of world history, in South America there was paganism all the time. And from what I understand, up until very recently, and even now, there are many peasants who worship all kinds of things. So I don't know. Meaning, in general, I don't know how to apply that Gemara. When I look at the world and I look at the Gemara, I don't know. I just don't know. I don't know at all. I also don't know how to understand the open promiscuity we've seen in the last century. Meaning, you look at it and you say, okay, why does that have to be? We see God is doing things. There's massive change in the world. Meaning, the world today is nothing like it's been from the time of creation. Maybe we're starting to get a glimpse of an understanding of what that great light that was hidden. Because in the information age, we're suddenly having information that we never had before. The amount of information, you know, there's a fire, a wildfire in California, and the whole world knows about it. And they, you know, that's what Chazal say, that in the beginning of creation, information was all over the world from the very beginning. And then God said, I have to hide this light. And now suddenly we're in a generation where there's so much of what Chazal alluded to about the Messianic era and about the beginning of creation. And yet you look at the world and there's such open promiscuity that you ask yourself, what's going on? I mean, in certain ways, this is worse than Sodom, what's going on today. So I'm not sure how we're supposed to understand. The Jewish people return to the land of Israel, and the whole world is going haywire. You never had this. Don't get me wrong. There was always promiscuity, but it wasn't open. Meaning, George Bush, you know, his next door neighbor went back to England because he couldn't know whose children it was. His or George Bush, not George Bush, George Washington. George Washington, you know, they don't write this in history books, but some history books do, the British ones. That George Washington's neighbor, you know, moved back to England because George Washington was an adulterer. Okay, so things were happening behind the scenes, but it wasn't as open as it has been in the past century. I don't know. I don't know how to understand that. I don't know why the world has taken this shift. And I think the price we're paying, there are a lot of things that you look at the world and you wonder, okay, there's a plan going on here, but I don't know what it is. How, you know, we have a generation now. What's happening now in the last 4 years is that children are growing up and it's a given that they don't have eye contact with their parents. It's becoming a norm that children spend their whole day watching their parents like this. What's this generation gonna, what's gonna happen with these people? Meaning if a child grows up and the norm in his house is that there's no eye contact with the parent, what type of adult is he going to be? I don't know. We're all in for a big surprise. And they tell you now that 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 children is being prescribed medication for autism. Look up the statistics. It's mind-boggling. But then again, emotionally, we're not developing the way we should. There's no... Parents, even if they take the kid to the park, their head is in their iPhone. So I'm saying the whole world is taking a turn. I'm not sure where we're headed, and I'm not sure how to understand it in light of the Gemara. Meaning you're asking me about one point, and I'm telling you there are major shifts happening in the last century. I look at the Gemara, and some things I say, okay, you look at Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, you see there are a lot of references to what's going to happen in a certain era down the road, and a lot of it seems to be coming true. It discusses that people will stop to use paper and pen. You know, there are all kinds of things that you suddenly look at our sages and you say, wow, wait a second, that was literal. All the years, how'd they understand that? You read certain things and you say, okay, but where was all that supposed to bring us? So you read it and you say, okay, but where's the application? Now what? I don't know yet. I say yet, I hope to still know. So far, I don't know. You asked one question, I'm telling you on a broader scale, I don't know. But we definitely see a shift in the whole world. I'm not sure where we're headed yet. One thing we are taught, that the world will reach a conclusion that the normal way to go is the way of the Torah. And it could be that the shifts that the world is undergoing now is to bring the world to that conclusion. Because the world has gone right, the world has gone left, the pendulum keeps swinging back and forth, and it could be that that's part of where we're headed. But I don't know. I don't know. We have 15 minutes, let's try to quickly finish the parasha. Yes?
So are you saying that the internet was in the beginning of time and then the light was hidden?
I don't know.
Exactly.
I don't know. What I'm saying is we have a medrash. And people read this Medrash for 4 millennia. Okay, the Medrash wasn't written yesterday. And now, okay, 3 millennia. And now we suddenly see the Medrash clearly, excuse the pun. What the Medrash means, I don't know. But what we have today is amazing. And I don't need to go to Google Glass, right? Think about it. You know, people today can wear glasses and see, they could be talking to someone across the world. And seeing them, right? If the guy's on Skype, you're literally seeing someone across the world. Okay, so I'm saying today we have an easy understanding of what it said. I don't think God needs the internet to let us see what's going on across the world. But now we have an easier understanding of the concept. Okay, yes?
I was wondering, I have 2 questions. Did I understand correctly that the Gemara is teaching that... people did Avodah Zarah or accepted it more easily because it allowed them to attach some kind of ritual significance to their promiscuous behavior or their impulsive behavior?
I think you're giving more credit to the Jewish people than they deserve, unfortunately. I think the idea is if I can find a legitimacy in some way I can placate my conscience and turn my back on the Torah... So then I can feel more comfortable doing my desires. I'm not sure they needed the rituals of the pagans in order to permit themselves. The Talmud tells us horrific stories about orgies and things that, like, you read it. And I always read it and wondered, like, can this really be? And then I discover that it's going on today. And I say, okay, if humanity can reach such lows, then I guess... When our sages wrote it, that's what was happening in the period of the first temple when people were going after paganism. So, okay, I guess...
Does it that was my other question, because now that this open promiscuity, as you named it, is getting is developing and it's becoming like part of normality in the secular society, where will this lead to? Where does it lead to when people follow their impulses into such an extent?
We have a rule. I'm not a prophet, but we do have a rule. The question is where to apply it. It says, "Kol makom." Anytime you see open, flagrant promiscuity, andralamusia ba'alaolam, heavy turmoil, if I'll use a gentle term, comes to the world. That's what our sages say. You could see, I think Rashi in Parshas Noach quotes it. But I don't know. There's been heavy promiscuity for many years, and things have, thank God, been relatively quiet in the 60s and 70s and 80s. So even if something happens now, why is it happening now and didn't happen then? So that's why I don't believe we know God's ways. The prophets knew. We don't know how to interpret. It could be a tsunami, it could be other things. Okay. So it says that the Jews will go against the covenant. God made a covenant with us that we're the chosen people, but we have to stick to his mitzvos. And we will try to turn on that. So God says, okay, doesn't work that way. You cannot turn on our treaty. You are responsible for the mitzvos, but I'm willing to play the game your way. Then I'm going to behave as though the treaty's annulled, even though you're still responsible for it, which is the general theme here. I'll also let bad things happen, and the Torah goes through the different fevers and illnesses, and that they planted, and the enemies would come and consume their crops, which actually happened throughout the period of the judges. God says the enemies will take away their sovereignty, which again happened throughout the period of the judges. And God says you won't get the hint then, so then I'll continue. Le'yasera etchem. You'll see this word throughout the parasha. What does the word le'yaser mean? So yisurim can be translated as afflictions, but it could also be translated, as we find throughout the book of Proverbs, it says, Yaser bincha. What does that mean? Afflict your son? No. The word yaser comes from the word sar, to remove. Meaning you're trying to remove what's wrong, or to move a person back onto the right path. So yisurim, although we often translate it as afflictions, it can also be translated as messages, arousals, methods of education, where Hashem says, okay, I'm going to try to bring you back. Li'yasera etchem, I will try to veer you back onto the right path. Now, obviously, throughout these periods, we were given warnings. You know, before the destruction, even Josephus writes this in the Second Temple. He says there were two miracles that everyone saw before the destruction of the Second Temple. There was, I think on Tisha B'Av, he writes, there were comets that came shooting towards the temple. They saw shooting stars going towards the temple, and this was witnessed by the masses. Now they knew the temple was destroyed, and the first temple was destroyed on this date. And suddenly they're getting that illusion again. And Josephus wasn't religious. He was from the Sadducees. Could be at some point he was religious, but he writes that before the destruction of the temple, I don't remember if it was a year or 3 years beforehand, the gates of the temple swung open, and they couldn't shut them. Whatever they did, they wouldn't shut. Now the Talmud says this. You read it in Talmud, and you read it, and you wonder, what does the Talmud mean it literally? But Josephus wasn't into writing midrashim. Josephus takes a lot of midrashim and tells you a different angle on the whole story. And here Josephus says everyone saw it and everyone knew it. And everyone had this premonition that, okay, this is a sign that destruction's coming. So the question is, what do you do with that sign?
Because the gates were shut open. open?
The gates couldn't be shut. As much as they tried, they couldn't fix them, couldn't get them shut. They would always stay open. And now the gates indicated this was the idea that as though God was saying, I'm leaving, I'm out of here, and the enemies have an open entrance. From my end, it's over. And that's our tradition, that there were things that happened that indicated that God had left the temple.
Second.
I'm saying even in the period of the second temple where you no longer had prophets, you still had signs that indicated destruction is looming. Now the question is, when you see that, what do you say? What do you do? So the Torah says it's all these things are liyasera, to help a person get back on the right track. So Hashem says there won't be rain, and people will work hard and the ground won't bear fruits. And what's the issue? God says, don't go with me, carry. Don't view things as coincidence. And that's why Nachmanides says we have a biblical mitzvah to pray when things go wrong. Because the Torah keeps warning us, if you view it as a coincidence, then you'll never repent, you'll never better your ways. And that's why when something goes wrong, a person has a mitzvah to stop and say, wait a second, maybe I should change my ways. Maybe I should be behaving differently. And what could God be wanting from me? Yes?
Is carry means also coincidence?
Carry means coincidence. Carry means an occurrence. And that's why when we speak about a man who has a wet dream, a man who's emitted his seed, so the Torah wants to use modest terms. And the Torah says, if he became defiled, mikirei laila, from an occurrence of the night. And it doesn't spell out what happened that night, because the Torah trains us to use modest terms, so that's why the Torah doesn't overtly say it. It calls it a happening, something happened. So it is the same word. So the Torah says, if you view all this destruction as a coincidence, so then I'll make it worse. And that's what the rebuke keeps doing. It keeps making it worse and worse. God says, then wild animals will come in and cause people to lose their children. And the wild animals will come in and destroy their herds, their cattle. And if they still think it's a coincidence, so God says, okay, so then I'll leave things to coincidence. I'll let nations come in and attack. And you'll have to gather into the cities. And within the cities, God says, I'll send in plagues. People will die within the cities. And we know this happened during the period of both destructions. And then God says, you'll have 10 women trying to bake bread in one oven, because they won't have firewood and they won't have bread. And they'll come back and they'll have a very slight amount of bread where everyone's going to be gauging exactly enough. And after everyone eats, no one will be satiated. And if that's not enough and you'll still think it's a coincidence, so God says, okay, then God brings it to a point where people eat their own children. And we know in the book of Kings, it's recorded that that's actually happened. The king was walking as there was a siege on Jerusalem. The king was walking around the wall, and a woman came and said, save me, the king. And he asked her, what's wrong? If God's not saving you, how am I going to save you? From where do you want me to give you food? And she says, that's not my issue. My issue is that my neighbor and I made a deal that we'll bake my child, we'll cook my child and eat him, and then we'll cook hers. And I did my end. We cooked my child, we ate him together, and now she's keeping her child for herself. She's not sharing with me. She's going to eat them all alone. And that's recorded. We read it in the prophecy a few weeks ago. That's recorded in the book of Kings, that it reached this point when there was a famine in Jerusalem as there was siege in the days of Elijah, Elisha the prophet. How do you say Elisha in English? Elijah is Elio, right? So Elisha is?
Elisha.
Elisha. Okay. In the days of Elisha, so this actually happened. And then God says, okay, and if that's not enough, finally, people will be exiled, and God will cause people to fall dead, and they will fall keel over on top of their feces. What's that talking about? So the Torah uses a derogatory term to describe their idols. God says people are going to be so clinging to their idols, which again was the first temple period, that even as they're dying, they'll hold on to their idols. The city was under siege, and the following story is recorded. Eliyahu met a young child, and he said to him, I see you're really hungry. Say Shema, say the Pasuk of Shema, and you'll be saved. And the kid looks up at Eliyahu, and he says, "Shh, I don't want to say God's name." And he pulls out of his pocket an idol. Now the kid is dying of hunger. And he kisses the idol and drops dead. And that's a fulfillment of this pasuk where the Navi says, they went so far after their paganism that even to their dying breath, they were holding on to the pagan god. But obviously it wasn't helping them. God says, yeah, if they'll go that far, then they won't let go then either. And that's a description Eliyahu describes. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, and that's a fulfillment of this pasuk. So when the pasuk says their corpses will fall over their feces, that's a way of saying fall over their idols. And the cities will be destroyed, and the temple will be destroyed. And God says the offerings won't give atonement, and the land will be desolate. That's one of the promises we have, that when other nations are here, the land is desolate. You know why it's called the Green Line, right? Because up to where we were living, it was green. And once we weren't living there, it was desolate. And if you look around, you see this is constantly fulfilled. When Am Yisrael is in the land of Israel, you guys can look up online Mark Twain's description of the land of Israel when he visited. A garbage dump. There's nothing growing. It's a wasteland. But we come here and everything thrives, right? God says, when you'll be gone, the land will be desolate. And it will rest all the years you didn't let it rest. So finally, the conclusion is, but the people will atone and they'll come back and God will maintain his covenant with us and we have to come back and keep the mitzvahs in the land of Israel. And that brings us to Shishi or Ravi, depends if the parashios are together. And then we have a few more mitzvot before we conclude the reading of the Torah. The idea of a person donating certain amounts to the temple, a person donating evaluations of himself, of children, of older people, younger people to the temple. And we have a mitzvah, lo yachlifenu v'lo yamir oto, you can't exchange. Once you dedicated an animal, you can't exchange it for another animal. So that's an interesting mitzvah. If you try to say, this sheep, Betsy, is instead of that sheep, Flossie. I know I dedicated Flossie to the temple, but now Betsy's going to be instead. So the Torah says they're both dedicated. They both are offered to the temple. We cannot take the holiness off of Flossie. So now Flossie and Betsy are dedicated to the temple. So the idea here is that we should have respect for things that are dedicated to the temple. If you dedicated it, so give it the way you promised. And the Torah is teaching us an approach of respect to the temple. Tov, well,